Today is Wednesday, the 14th of March, 2012. This recording is of Jerry Carr, and it is being made at his home in Manchester Center, Vermont.
Well, I grew up in Santa Ana, California, and had an abiding interest in airplanes and Boy Scouting. And at the age of 14, a friend of mine and I rode our bicycles about 15 miles to Orange County Airport, which is now called John Wayne Airport. And every Saturday morning, we would spend the morning washing airplanes, and then for our pay, it was a free ride in an airplane. And so that kind of helped cement my desire to become a pilot. Boy Scouting was a very important part of my life all through my junior high and high school years. And I achieved the rank of Eagle Scout, and I still write letters of congratulations to Eagle Scouts all over the United States now. Whenever a Scoutmaster writes me and tells me he has a youngster who's getting his Eagle badge, that I send him a letter of congratulations. But that was an important part of my life, and it was a very formative part of my life, because as a Boy Scout, I learned self-confidence and leadership, and the airplane idea followed right along with it. As a senior in high school, I joined the Naval Reserve and learned how to be what they call a plane captain. That's the young person who inspects the airplane and gets it ready for the pilot. And one of the jobs I had to do was warm up the airplane. So I had, as a high school senior, I had the delightful job of starting the engine of an F-6F airplane and warming it up. And that was pretty heady stuff for a kid who was about 18 years old. When I left, finished high school, I went on to the University of Southern California with the Naval ROTC and graduated from high school with a degree in mechanical engineering and a commission as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps then sent me to Quantico, Virginia for what we call Charm School, and it's sort of officer's basic school, or officer's boot camp. And from there, I went to Pensacola, where I learned how to fly, and spent the next 11 years of my life as a Marine fighter pilot. And I flew airplanes from Cherry Point, North Carolina, and from an aircraft carrier, the Roosevelt, the Franklin D. Roosevelt, in the Mediterranean. Had a brief period of time when I went to the Navy postgraduate school and received another bachelor's degree, this time in aeronautical engineer. And they sent me off to Princeton to get a master's degree, then back into the fighter squadron business. And because I was an engineer, I was almost always in the maintenance department of every fighter squadron I was in. And I ended my tour of duty in Japan in 1963 and 4 as the maintenance officer of a Marine fighter squadron. So I had 24 airplanes and 180 men that I had to take care of. When I returned from Japan, I was given a job and assigned to a squadron in Southern California, and I was flying an LMD. Now, LMD means large mahogany desk, and pilots don't like LMDs. They're not very much fun. But it's a part of the duty we all have to do. We have to do our administrative duty and earn our spurs, so to speak. And after I had been there for about a year, NASA came out with an announcement they were going to accept applications for a new group of astronauts. And so I decided I would give that a try just to see how far I would get in the process. I didn't really expect to get selected, but I really wanted to know how far I could get. So I did that and put in the applications, all of the letters of recommendation from fighter squadron commanders, and waited for about 6 or 7 months and never heard a thing. Finally, in late 1965, I got a notice from NASA saying that they had had 88,700 applications, that they had reduced the group to 300, that I was one of them, and they wanted me to go to get a physical examination at the Aerospace School of Medicine at San Antonio. Well, I went there, and I was surprised to see that all 300 of us were there at the same time for the physical. So it was what I would call organized chaos. It was 3 days of very, very intensive, invasive medical examinations. I think they probably inspected every orifice in my body. And when they were finished with us, they said, "Okay, gentlemen, you can go home, go back to your duty stations." So we all went back home again, and I resumed my duties. I had pretty much forgotten about it because it was another couple of months. And when I got another notice that I was to be among the last group of 50 to go to Houston, and they wanted to do an oral interview. So I flew to Houston and checked in at the hotel they told me to check in at. And the lady at the desk gave me an envelope with the time and the place of my interview. And so the next morning at that appointed time, I went to what was the Grand Ballroom was the place. And as I opened the door to the ballroom and looked in, it was totally empty except for along the far wall from the door was a very long green table with 6 very serious-looking guys sitting behind it. And out in front of the table was one single chair with, would you believe, a spotlight from the ceiling on the chair. And my first thought was that this looked more like a court-martial than an interview. Well, we talked for about 45 minutes. We discussed everything from philosophy and religion to fighter pilot tactics. And when that 45 minutes was up, they said, "Okay, you can go on back to your duty station now, and thank you." So I went back feeling very proud of the fact that I had gotten to the 50 cut, but really didn't expect to hear again, so I went back to work. Well, on the 1st of April of 1966, I was at a meeting in Los Angeles. The unit I was working with at the time was buying a new radar system from the Marine Corps, for the Marine Corps, from Litton Industries. And we were having what's called a critical design review, and that is there were about 25 of us engineers in this conference room, and I was the chairman of the review, and we were going through all of the drawings and the nitty-gritty having to do with this radar system. And if we approved it at the end of the meeting, we would sign the necessary papers to authorize Litton to go ahead with the development of it. And about halfway through our program, a young lady came in from the reception area, and she said, "Major Carr, there's a Captain Shepherd on the phone who'd like to speak with you, and he says it's important." Well, I had a young captain working for me named Captain Bill Shepherd, and I was wondering why in the world Bill was calling me at a time like this, because he knew this was an important meeting. And I decided to go ahead and take it anyway, because since he knew, it probably was important. So I picked up the phone, identified myself, and the voice on the other end of the line said, "Jerry, this is Alan Shepherd at the Manned Space Flight Center in Houston. And I wanted to inform you that you've been selected to be one of the 19 new astronauts. And will you accept the duty?" And I said, "Well, yes, of course, I would be happy to. I'm delighted." And he said, "But there's just one thing." He said, "There won't be a press conference release on this for 2 days. So you'll have to keep this under your hat. You can tell your wife, but please don't tell anybody else." Well, after I hung up, I looked around and everybody was looking at me, and I must have looked pretty silly, with a silly expression on my face and probably floating up out of my chair. And I had assured him I wouldn't say a word, so I didn't say a word, and we went ahead with the meeting. And quite frankly, I don't remember anything else that happened that afternoon. But when I went home that night, I walked in the back door. My wife was in the kitchen preparing dinner for the family. And I said, "Guess what? I got a call from Alan Shepherd, and I'm going to be an astronaut." And she looked at me, and she looked over at the calendar that said the 1st of April, and said, "Yeah, April Fool." 30 days later, I was in Houston, reporting for duty, and began my training as an astronaut. Normally, astronaut training takes about one full year, and it includes such subjects as astronomy, astrophysics, flight physiology, and that's orbital trajectories or orbital management. And But in this particular year, the Apollo program was right on the heels of the Gemini program, and it was necessary that all of the astronauts have an intensive training in geology. So they added that extra half year, and we got the equivalent of about a master's degree in geology without all of the other side courses, just strictly geology. Another part of the astronaut basic training is survival training. In the days of Gemini, you never knew for sure where a spacecraft might land if there was an emergency deorbit. And so we had to take desert training, water training, and jungle survival training. And so we had to learn how to cook and eat snake and all other such other good things as that, and how to make water in the desert. After that year and a half of astronaut basic training, our names were all put on a list called the Flight Ready Astronaut List. And that list was quite a bit longer at that time than there were seats available, because we were right at the cusp between the Gemini program and the Apollo program. And so we were all given other duties to keep us occupied and to help continue our training with a lot of the systems. Five of us were assigned to the lunar module. The lunar module was being built in Long Island, New York, at the Bethpage plant of Grumman. And we spent every week at Grumman babysitting the lunar modules as they were being put through their assembly lines. Each one of us was assigned to two modules. My first module was LTA-8, which is a lunar training article is what it means. And it was a lunar module that would never fly. It was strictly for the astronauts to train in. The other lunar module I had was lunar module number 6. And our job was to be with these lunar modules as they were being built. And the structure was built first, and then they would lay in a system. And at that time, the astronaut would get in the lunar module in the white room and test the systems out, make sure they were working properly, and worked with a test conductor and a team of people who were all watching everything. Sometimes the test didn't go all that well. I don't want people to think that this just happens very quickly. It takes weeks to put in a system, and it takes a couple more weeks to test it. So we spent a lot of time there. Quite frequently during a test, the test conductor would come up to the astronaut on the intercom system and say, "Well, we've got a problem here. We've run into a glitch," is what we called it. And in many cases, he would say, you go ahead and get out of the spacecraft, and we'll call you back in a few hours when it's time to go again. But also quite frequently, he would say, "Why don't you just sit tight there for half an hour or so, and we'll get this thing cleared up and move on with the test." And sometimes it took a whole lot more than a half hour. So I must admit that probably I have more time sleeping on the floor of lunar module number 6 than the crew who flew it on the moon. That was our first job. It lasted a little over a year. And when all the lunar modules were completed and in storage, in their clean storage at Bethpage, Long Island, we went back to Houston and waited for our next job. Well, my next job was to be on the support crew of Apollo 8. And Apollo 8 was the spacecraft that flew to the moon and came back but did not land. The job of the support crew member is he's the third stringer. The first string is a prime crew. The second string is a backup crew. The third string is the support crew. And the support crew is usually made up of rookies, and it's usually the jobs they get are all the dull jobs, the dirty jobs, and things like that, and very little recognition. Nobody knows who the support crew is. But the good news is that when the support crew finishes its work, they become part of the mission control, and they serve in a position called capsule communicator, which we called CAPCOM, And the capsule communicator in those days was the only person who could speak to the crews on orbit. No one else could speak to them, only the astronaut who was in the CAPCOM console. And so it was a good job. We got really in the thick of the missions, and on Apollo 8, I had the job of being on the CAPCOM console when they went behind the moon for the first time. When they went behind the moon, they were supposed to do a thrusting maneuver to slow them down so they'd be captured into lunar orbit. This is the first time that, I think, had ever happened, and NASA was not too wild about the idea that these guys were going to be doing a thrusting maneuver where NASA couldn't watch him and didn't have downlink to make sure everything was going okay. So we just had to sit and cool our heels when they went behind the moon. And we knew if they came out a little early on the other side that they had not burned enough, not slowed down enough, and they were going to just skip out into space. They wouldn't be captured into orbit. If they came out a little bit late, it meant they had overdone it. It meant they weren't going to be in orbit, but were going to begin a spiral down to the lunar surface. And, of course, without a lunar module, that kind of ruins your whole day. You can imagine how relieved we were at the instant that they were supposed to appear on the other side of the moon, that they appeared. And from then on, it was a fairly routine mission. It was a reconnaissance mission. They did lots of photography of the lunar surface with the thought of getting shots of where the lunar future lunar landings might be. And so that was my job on Apollo 8. My next assignment was again a support crew assignment on Apollo 12, and the reason that I got that assignment was because I was the lunar module number 6 was going to fly on that mission, and that's a second manned mission on the moon. And since that was my lunar module, I had to meet it at the Cape, Cape Canaveral, and follow it, babysit it all through its repeated testing, and then stacking it on the top of the booster and getting it ready to fly. And upon completion of that job, I went back and was in mission control, again as a CAPCOM, and my job, first job on capsule communicator this time was on the launch of Apollo 12. Well, Apollo 12 was struck by lightning, and on its way off the pad, a nearby thunderstorm, there was a lightning bolt that went over and hit the very tip of the spacecraft. Went down, the charge went down through the spacecraft, through the booster, down the exhaust gases, and grounded out on the launching pad. Well, the on its way through the command and service module, it killed the electrical power system, and the computers all died. And so the crew was going up blind. You can imagine what it must have been like for them inside, because everything was going fine until suddenly the lights all went out, and then they came back on when the batteries picked up the load, and the computers had all fallen off the line. And every single warning light and caution light in the spacecraft was on and flashing, and all of the necessary bells, whistles, and buzzers and things that are in there all were going off at the same time. The crew was totally confused as to what was going on. The people on the ground in mission control, the console for a capsule communicator and for the mission director are in the back, and they're elevated above the others so they can see out over the sea of consoles. And from back there, we could see that every single console had flashing lights on them, except one, and that was the booster console. People were getting up and sitting down and sending information back to the mission director, who was on my right side, and he had the responsibility of deciding whether or not we would abort the mission or whether we would go ahead with it. The booster people kept reassuring us that the booster was on trajectory and everything was just fine. And so he made the decision not to abort, but to let the booster take them, put them up into orbit, and then we would see what we could do with it. Well, that's what we did. We got them into orbit. We rebooted the computers, got the batteries off the line, and got the fuel cells back up again, the normal electrical generating system. And when we were settled in orbit, we tested all the various systems, and everything looked good. So the mission director went out on a limb again, and this time he gave him a go for what they call translunar injection, and that is that the thrusting maneuver that takes them out of Earth orbit and puts them on their way to the moon. Well, when they arrived at the moon, the Apollo 12 landed within a couple hundred feet of a spacecraft that had landed there several years earlier called Surveyor. Surveyor was a little three-legged, like a milk stool kind of a vehicle. Sitting on the ground, it had a little scoop on it, and the scoop would pick up some of the lunar soil, and then it would inspect it with a spectrograph, and then it would drop the soil and then swing around and pick up elsewhere. And so on one of the spacewalks that the two guys from Apollo 12 did, they brought a pair of bolt cutters with them, and they went over to this little Surveyor spacecraft and snipped off a few pieces and brought them back home again so we could see what kind of effect a long period of time on a moon has on a spacecraft that's sitting on the moon. So that was the second big mission control task that I had. And I thought by now, certainly I had gotten up far enough on the list to where I would now be ready for an assignment. But I didn't get one. I got one more assignment, this time with the Lunar Rover vehicle. The Lunar Rover is the little dune buggy that was used to allow the astronauts to range out further away from the spacecraft and gather more samples on the moon. And this was used on Apollo 15, 16, and 17. Well, we built the Lunar Rover in California, in Santa Barbara, at the Delco plant, Electronics. And the Boeing company was also a contractor on that. And that whole program took only a year. We did our testing at a nearby beach called Pismo Beach, California. Pismo Beach in those days was called Dune Buggy Heaven because anybody who had a dune buggy in the late 60s and early 70s, anyone who had a dune buggy wanted to run it on Pismo Beach because of the dunes. Well, one day we were out on Pismo Beach with the Lunar Rover, and Jack Lausma, the other astronaut that was assigned with me to it, was sitting in the Lunar Rover, and he was in his full pressure suit, fully pressurized, and he was driving it very slowly through the sand. I was walking behind him with the cable over my shoulder that provided him his electrical power, and behind me was a pickup truck with a generator. And as he was moving along, we suddenly heard this roar, and over the top of a sand dune nearby came a dune buggy. And he was really moving, because when he hit the top of the dune, he got airborne. And when he saw us, he obviously put on the brakes, because when he landed on our side of the dune, he stuck. His eyes got as big as saucers. He put it in reverse and backed up over the sand dune and never came back. So now I figured this is it. And sure enough, I did get an assignment, a flight assignment. I was assigned to the backup crew of Apollo 16, which meant that I was to be, according to the normal sequence of events, I was going to be on the prime crew of Apollo 19. It was going to be commanded by Fred Hayes. I was to be the lunar module pilot, and Bill Pogue was going to be the command module pilot, who had to stay in lunar orbit while the two of us went down to the lunar surface. We began training as the backup crew of Apollo 16, and several weeks into the training, NASA made the surprise announcement that they were going to cancel Apollos 18, 19, and 20. And the reason for that was budgetary. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War, and the budget was in bad shape, and NASA, along with other government agencies, had to give up program in order to keep the budget afloat. So you can imagine there were three very, very sad hangdog guys moping around the office because we lost our flight to the moon. But several weeks later, I got a call from Tom Stafford, the senior astronaut at that time, and he wanted me in his office, and I went in, and he told me that he was sorry that I had missed my opportunity for the moon, but he said, "I've got another assignment for you." He said, "I want you to be the commander of the third and final Skylab mission. Your crew is going to be Bill Pogue and Ed Gibson, if you can work with them, And it's going to last anywhere from 60 to 90 days. And he said, do you think you can work with those and do the job? And I said, of course, yes. But I'll have to admit a certain lump in my chest and in my stomach, because I was a rookie. And they normally don't assign a rookie to be a commander. Usually you have to have at least one flight under your belt. But they assigned me to that, which was really a kind of a shock, because the last rookie commander was Neil Armstrong on Gemini 8. We began our training. It started in 1973, and we trained for 3 years. We had to learn how to operate two different spacecraft systems, the command and service module system, as well as the Skylab system. We had to learn how to do three major experiments. One had to do with solar physics, the study of the sun. The primary mission there was the study of the human body, because we needed to understand what it takes to keep a human in space for a long period of time, because there were a lot of problems beginning to show up. And the third main task was the study of the Earth itself. Now, the reason why the physiology was important was that in the early missions, Mercury, Gemini, and the early Apollos, astronauts were coming back from the missions suffering from what's called cardiovascular deconditioning and a good deal of muscle loss in the thighs, the buttocks, and the calves. And this was worrisome, because we felt that if an astronaut stayed in space too long, he or she might come back and have a problem with the heart, because the heart muscle, when you're weightless, doesn't get very much workout. It you're not pumping against gravity to get blood to your brain, and so the heart has an easy job of it. And what happens to muscles that you don't use? They get weak and flabby. So also did the heart muscle. Now, the question is, what can we do? We know why it's happening, but what can we do about it? So we decided that exercise is probably the logical thing to try first. That's what you do when you have weak, flabby muscles. After, say, a long bed rest or something like that, you work out and get them strong. So the first crew to Skylab was a 28-day mission, 30 minutes a day for exercise every day, and they did it. When they came back from their mission, they were not in good shape, and the doctors and the crew were unhappy about that. The second crew with a 59-day mission was given a full hour every day on their schedule, and they exercised a full hour every single day. When they got back from the mission, the doctors looked them over and they said, well, it looks to us like you're probably in better shape than the first crew, but still not good enough. So my crew was given an hour and a half every day, and we did it religiously every single day. And when we came back from our mission, the doctors looked us over and they said, well, it looks to us like maybe you're in better shape now than when you left. So we said, right on, you know, we've bounded the problem. On the International Space Station that's flying right now, the astronauts and cosmonauts living up there exercise for anywhere from 2.5 to 3 hours a day. They've got some very nice, very well-designed, sophisticated exercise equipment. And we've had people that have stayed up for a year. The normal tour of duty is anywhere from 3 months to 6 months, and they're all coming back in reasonably good shape. So we're feeling good about exercise as the countermeasure for cardiovascular deconditioning. In the future, we're looking at a 2.5-year Mars mission, and for that kind of a mission, you're looking at a year to get there, a half a year on station, and a year to get back. So right now, we're very hopeful that the exercise, if we do it properly, will continue to protect the astronauts from deconditioning when they get back to the Earth from Mars. Now, on Skylab, we also had a little added extra bonus, and that was that the new comet Kohoutek was discovered early January of 73, and they determined it was going to pass closest to the sun and the Earth, called perihelion. Perihelion was going to occur in Christmas Day of 1973 while we were up there. So they did a little more calculations, and after a while they determined that the period of this comet, that is the amount of time it takes that comet to go around the sun one time, was 2,000 years. which meant that the last humans that had seen the comet Kohoutek were about the time of the birth of Christ. And this really kicked up the Christian theologians. They got all excited and said that possibly they began to speculate that possibly the star that appeared above Bethlehem was really the comet Kohoutek. The scientific community was also very excited about it because it's the first time, for all intents and purposes, that human beings could see it and study it who had enough knowledge to understand what they were doing. So in November of 73, the whole world was very, very excited about comet Kohoutek. There were magazine articles, newspaper articles, and people in November started looking up in the heavens to get a chance to see this little comet. But unfortunately, it was a weak sister. It was a very weak comet. And people couldn't see it on the ground with the naked eye. And unless they knew someone with a backyard telescope who could focus it properly and point it, or if they could go to an observatory, no one down here got a chance to see it. But we on Skylab outside the Earth's atmosphere had a very good view of it. It was weak, it was beautiful. And as we gathered up our cameras and were getting ready to put film in them to start taking some pictures every night, the people on the ground said, "Hold it, guys, that's not going to work. The film is not sensitive enough to capture the image." But not to worry, because all good astronauts bring their Crayolas and coloring books up there with them. So we drew pictures of the comet, and we colored them, and we brought them back down, turned them over to the astronomers, and they compared them with the photographs they had taken through their eyepiece of their telescope to make sure there was correlation between the two. So that's basically the Skylab mission. In summary, really, Skylab is America's first space station. It was part of a much larger program called Apollo. And it was phase two of the Apollo program, phase one meaning the lunar landings, and phase three being the Apollo-Soyuz test project, where Russians and Americans rendezvoused in space and lived together for a few days. And the third main task was to study the Earth itself. The Skylab program turned out to be a very valuable program because we overcame that initial hurdle of the concern about staying in space for a long period of time. And I must say that I've met several cosmonauts who have flown on their space station, Mir, and also on the International Space Station, and they've all thanked us for the work we did on studying the human body while we were up there, because one of our major experiments on the human body was to study not only the conditioning, but also to study human metabolism on orbit and how your body processes the food that you eat. We were on a very strict diet, very well tightly controlled diet, in which things were all very carefully measured. And also everything that came out was also carefully measured and brought home again, too, for analysis. So they treated us kind of like a internal combustion engine. As a mechanical engineer, I had one course in which we had an engine, and we had the fuel and the air being measured. It was going into it, and we measured the exhaust coming out of it, and we measured how much work it did by the brake horsepower that you could get out of the thing. And so it was just a human being treated like an engine, but it turned out to be very valuable information. Well, after the Skylab mission, the first thing we do when we got back on the ground was debrief, and that usually takes several weeks. And they have a prepared debrief sheet. This was actually a book this time because it was so long. And all of the investigators whose experiments we were doing had questions about how this went, how that went, and any other observations that we had. And that's your first job. The next job after you finish your debriefings is what they call a hometowner. They send you back to your hometown. And so my wife and family and I went back to Santa Ana, California, and I did quite a few speeches, talked to a lot of people, was in a short parade. And then after the hometowner comes usually some trip abroad in order to speak to scientific communities in other countries. And my job, my trip this time was to go to Hungary and to East Germany. And this was all before the wall came down. And so I went to those countries and spoke to their academies of science, and brought my wife, came along with me. And we got a good look at the kind of repression that the Russians had inflicted on the various countries. Hungary was not as bad as East Germany. East Germany was really very badly downtrodden, and people were unhappy. Every once in a while, you'd get some kind of a side comment from some scientist about their people who were visiting them and their guests, so to speak. And then we went from there we went to Sweden to be the guests of Victor Hasselblad, who built the Hasselblad camera that we used on Skylab. Well, actually, it was used all the way back into the Apollo program. And we had a wonderful, quiet 5 days with Victor Hasselblad and his wife and family in Gothenburg, Sweden. And then we came back home, and that was about it. Then it was time for a new assignment. This time I was assigned to the crew station group of the astronaut office for the shuttle design. And we worked on the design of the shuttle cockpit, and I also had another job as working with the Canadian robot arm, testing it out to see how it was going to work on the shuttle. And we did most of the design of the shuttle cockpit using foam core and razor blades and marker pencils and things like that, picking out the manner in which the control panel should be laid out, how far they should be from the seat, what's the vision, the fields of vision, and things like that for the astronaut flying. The robot arm, we had a huge mock-up of the payload bay of the shuttle as it was expected to be, and we had a prototype of the Canadian robot arm, and we had some big balloons that were about the size of some of the payloads that we were to put in and out of the payload bay. And we just evaluated the control systems for that particular kind of a robot arm. And you might think of the payload bay as being about the size of the bed of a semi-truck. And some of the payloads that we were supposed to pick up and put into that payload bay were about the size of the body or the box of a truck. And we required closed-circuit TV cameras in order to see all the clearance areas and the places where it would lock down. And I always like to think of that as like trying to put an elephant in your shirt pocket. It's very difficult to see. And you really had to move slow. But it's turned out that the robot arm has been a very, very useful and important part of the space station system. In 1977, I retired from NASA. I should say I retired from the Marine Corps in 1975 and was a civil servant for a couple of years working for NASA on the shuttle cockpit. And one of the nice things about retirement from the Marine Corps, I should mention, is that my retirement ceremony was held in Washington, D.C. at the Marine Corps barracks at 8th and I, which is the home of the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And they do a wonderful parade and within the context, within the confines of the Marine barracks. And I was asked if I wanted to invite any other guest of honor, so I invited John Glenn to come with me. So he and I reviewed the troops at 8th and I, and he leaned over to me at one time and he said, "My wife always makes me leave my wallet at home because she's afraid I'll sign up again." But That was a nice way to leave the Corps. The commandant at that time was Lewis Wilson, and he gave my wife a little gold-plated rose, replica of a rose. It was about 8 inches long, and to it was affixed a little plaque that said, "We didn't promise you a rose garden." And that was how I left NASA. I decided to get into my real basic degree, and that is engineering. So I hired on with an engineering firm in Houston called Beauvais Engineers, and I learned all the business of designing and building waste treatment plants, water treatment plants, airports, and things like that. I lasted about 4.5 years with them, and then I got homesick for the aerospace industry again. And I had been doing a little bit of moonlighting with an outfit in Los Angeles, having to do with the Air Force aerospace program, and I decided that I'd talked with Bill Pogue, and Bill and I decided that we really think we should do something about getting back into the design of spacecraft, particularly the International Space Station, because we felt like we had a lot of information we could plow back into it. So I formed up a corporation called Camus Incorporated, and that was CA for car, MUS for music, which is my second wife's last name, and that acronym. And we ended up with Camus, and we said, well, that's the name of an existentialist philosopher and also a good Napoleon brandy, so it's probably a good name. So that was the name of our company. Bill Pogue and I then offered the services of Camus to various aerospace companies. We said we felt that we could be helpful with the space station program that was being proposed by NASA, and various companies were getting ready to bid on it. Several of the companies were very excited about having us come to work with them, but all they wanted to use us for was window dressing and to help them get the contract. And Bill and I said, "No, you don't understand. What we want to do is we want to be in the trenches with the people who are doing the design work, and we want to help with the design. And we're not interested in the marketing stuff." The only company that really responded to that line of thinking was Boeing. Boeing had a lot of new young engineers in their aerospace division, and they wanted those engineers to be well-trained. And so they hired us as a subcontractor to train their engineers and to help them with the design of the International Space Station, particularly as it applies to the human interfaces, how humans react with equipment and how they move around inside a spacecraft. So we spent 13 years on the International Space Station with the design work, and in 1999, when the first part of it went up, it was time to stop and retire, which I did. From then on, my only involvement with NASA has been in a public affairs, public relations kind of a role, going a couple times a year to the Kennedy Space Center and doing short speeches to families who are visiting the visitor center there and very interested in knowing more about the space program. So I'm still somewhat of a teacher and enjoying every minute of it. During the period of time between my mission and when I retired from NASA, at one time, Wernher von Braun had decided that he wanted to come to Houston and get a good look at what the shuttle was developing into. He'd seen lots of drawings and pictures, but he wanted to see the mock-ups. So I was selected to be his escort, and we didn't know it at that time, but Wernher was terminal with cancer. And I met him, and we went to the big mock-up area where that big payload bay was located. And we climbed up a ladder, a long, long ladder, and got into the side door of the orbiter. And he climbed up another ladder and got into the cockpit, looked it all over, and then he got down and looked around the mid-deck area where where the sleeping areas are and the habitation area is. And then we got down on our hands and knees and crawled through the tunnel that goes from the cockpit to the payload bay. And we stood up, and when there's a catwalk down the center of the payload bay where people can walk. And so we started walking there, and he grabbed my arm, and we kind of walked it arm in arm like the European way a lot of men do walk. And he was looking around, and we stopped in the middle of the payload bay, and he looked at me, and he said, "Jerry," he said, "you know, this is all well and good. This is a wonderful piece of machinery." But he said, "If I had had the opportunity to fly in space myself, the mission I would have chosen was yours." And the reason why he did that, because he was always a proponent of the idea that that humans should have a permanent presence in space. That was one of his credos. And I immediately understood why he had said that, and was very, very flattered that he would say such a thing to me. During the launch, people asked me quite frequently, "Weren't you scared?" And my answer to them is no. The reason being that I'd waited 7.5 years for the opportunity to do what I was doing at that time. And once we launched, I was too busy to be frightened. There are too many things to do. And your mind is totally taken up with what's going on, and you have no time. There's no room in your mind to harbor fear. So that kind of takes care of the fear and the anxiety kind of thing. Exhilaration is something that we felt before the launch. We had waited so long for our mission that about 2 minutes before liftoff, we kind of looked at each other as we were lying there on the couches and we all started laughing because we'd waited so long for this opportunity. The launch itself is fairly rough and bumpy and noisy, and the noise doesn't calm down much until you exceed the speed of sound, and then the noise can't catch up and come in from the outside. It all has to come up through the structure, so the noise changes. And I must say that after the escape tower was jettisoned and my windows were clear and open, I could see out. I didn't see anything I recognized, and I was confused. I didn't really know which way north was, and hadn't thought about it before the launch, which way to look. But there was a great moment of revelation when we approached Western Europe, and I looked down, and I saw Italy, and I recognized Italy. And I tell people, yeah, Italy really is shaped like a boot. And that was a wonderful experience, which I've never forgotten. It suddenly clicked everything into place in terms of orientation and that sort of thing. And then looking down at the Earth for the first time from space, my memories are more an amalgamation of many memories looking down. There's not a single instant of amazement. It's a collection of small amazements. And basically, my thought was, when I looked down at the Earth, it's a beautiful, beautiful planet. We were pretty close to it, so we didn't see it as a marble. We saw a whole window full of planet. And but you get a chance to see deep space as well. And when you suddenly realize that this planet of ours is a very, very small place in a very, very large expanse. And it suddenly kind of falls on you that, you know, we've really got to take care of this environment of ours. Because we're the only people who can. We are the stewards of the environment of our atmosphere, and if we don't take care of it, there's no other place to go. And that is a feeling that I have shared with many astronauts and cosmonauts, and we've all felt the same way. In fact, my wife Pat and I, back in 1980, went to the United Nations. We were invited to be there for Earth Day, and there were 50 astronauts and cosmonauts that were invited to come. And as we were, they were going to have a celebration, and they had a huge video screen up above the dais. This was in the General Assembly. And on that huge video screen, they had were projecting the crew of a Soyuz Salyut space station that was up there at that time. And the cosmonauts were asked a few questions, and they made it a few announcements up there, and then they faded off of the TV screen, and they had asked in the green room by the dais, they had asked six of the astronauts and cosmonauts to please, in 1 minute, tell the audience how you felt when you looked down at the Earth from space for the first time. And they chose six different languages to be spoken. So they chose an astronaut or a cosmonaut to represent each language. The American was Mary Cleave, and Mary stood up there on the dais and said in her minute that just what I got finished saying, that is that it's a beautiful, beautiful place. There is a sudden feeling of fragility of our planet in the vastness of space, and that we have to be good stewards of it. We have to take care of our planet, and we have to live in harmony, because when we don't live in harmony, we do more damage to the planet than we think we do. So then the other five people got up and spoke, and there was a Frenchman, a German, a Russian, a Saudi, and Costa Rica, Spanish. And they all spoke, and of course, most of us on the dais just knew one language. But the families and all the people in the General Assembly had all of the interpreters in their little booths, and they had their headphones on, so they heard everything in their native language. So when it was all over, I went down to off the dais down to the main floor and walked over to Pat, and I said, "Well, what did they all say?" And she said, "You won't believe this, but they all said the same thing." And that's been the subject of an art exhibit that Pat and I have put together just recently. And that was over 20 years ago. So it has taken that long for the idea to gestate to the point where we might be able to express it in an art exhibit. And that's kind of the feeling that the astronauts get when they get up there. I remember looking out into deep space. When you get on the dark side of the Earth, then you can see all, if you look away from the Earth, you can see all the billions of stars that are out there. And there's a billion more out there than you can see down here on the Earth, even on a clear night in a mountain area. And suddenly makes you realize that there's a lot of suns out there like our sun. And if any of those suns have got planets working around them, then there may be a planet with an atmosphere like ours, or an atmosphere that supports intelligent life. And so there could be someone out there. But the proviso, or the thing that takes you back, is the fact that you're looking, when you see some of these stars and things, they're a billion miles away. And there's no way those people, whoever they are, elsewhere, are going to be able to communicate with us, and us with them, we with them. So it kind of makes you feel that you're out there all by yourself. My thought is that the important thing is that we all need to live in harmony. And if we're gonna make it as a species for very much longer, we're going to have to protect our environment and show some respect for each other. And that kind of followed me all along, and people still ask me today about that, and periodically I tell them this story. And I just most recently did a prayer breakfast down in Cocoa, Florida, in which I said the same thing. And I was a little bit anxious about that, because there were probably half of the room were fundamentalists, and it was interesting to watch and look and see if there were any changes of expression. Most were very stoic, and several people came up to me afterwards and said they thought it was very good, but nobody came up to argue with me. So that's kind of where I stand from a religious standpoint. It's been an interesting trip for me. I've been a Presbyterian most all of my life, as he from youth up, always active in the church, but never really gave it any serious, really serious thought until I was in orbit, looking down at the earth and starting to wondering about the true identity of God and what it all means. And so it's been an interesting ride from that standpoint. As for what the kinds of things I'm doing now, when I retired from NASA in 77 and then finally gave up the aerospace program in 99, I've devoted most of my life now to working with my wife, who is an artist and a sculptor, and teaching young people, and public speaking, being an advocate of the space program and the advocate of exploration. And that's been my job, apparently, since 1999, to be doing that. I mentioned the exhibit that we have, Pat and I have put together, having to do with our fragile environment. The name of it is Our Fragile Home. And we've collaborated quite a bit on it. I did a lot of she did most of the design, and I do a lot of the fabrication construction work on it.